This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, February 6, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. KUAF is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, celebrating the American spirit by uniting the power of art with the beauty of nature. The museum opens at 11 a.m. daily, except Tuesdays. More information is available online at crystalbridges.org.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, in the first of two reports, we examine policies and practices that have emerged to keep students safe from gun violence in schools.
Plus, we'll learn more about norovirus, and we examine the results of a poll conducted by the Diane D. Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society and the Clinton School of Public Service.
Those stories and more, but first, members of the Arkansas House of Representatives say a convicted rapist shouldn't have parental rights should the rape victim become pregnant and decide to keep the baby. Representative John Edwards of Little Rock, a Democrat who sponsored the bill, says it's an unlikely scenario, but should be law.
Think about this. A woman's been raped. She finds out that she's pregnant. She decides to carry the child. During the trial of her rapist, she is served with custody papers.
That's the situation Edwards wants to prevent. He says that's what happened to a Missouri woman before a judge intervened on her behalf. The bill does not remove child support responsibilities. No one spoke against the bill, and there were no votes against it. It now goes to a Senate committee.
School districts will not be able to count homeschool students as public school students in order to avoid school consolidation after a House committee hearing this morning. Democratic Representatives James Ratliff of Imboden sponsored the bill that would not have provided any funding, but would have counted homeschoolers in a district's student population. Rich Nagel of the Arkansas Education Association spoke against the bill, saying its wording is problematic.
You could have 349 homeschool students and only one student left in the school district, the way the bill is structured at the present time, and they would receive $6,276 for that one student. And I don't think that we would be saying that there's an adequate educational program being offered.
A representative from the Attorney General's office spoke against the bill, saying it would likely draw a successful legal challenge. Officials from two small school districts told lawmakers the bill would prevent students from having to take long bus rides to consolidated districts.
A new come-and-go gas station will eventually be built at the site of a former Tyson plant in Fayetteville. After tabling the issue last month, the city council heard revised offers from competing bidders. After two identical offers of $900,000 for the nearly two-acre plot were presented to the council at its last meeting in January, Casey's General Store upped its offer to nearly $1.16 million. But in a 5-3 vote, the city council voted to sell to Come and Go at its revised offer of nearly $1.12 million, with the promise that the building would be LEED certified. The council also voted unanimously to terminate the city's contract with Millionaire Fayetteville, the fixed base operator for Drake Field. The city terminated the contract after the company had problems in meeting its contractual payment obligations to the city in a timely manner. As a result, the city will take over operations of the airport. City Airport Director Ray Boudreau says with the city running the show, he expects the airport's revenue could grow, but as with any business, growth depends upon the market for the airport's services.
With the margins appropriately established and the quantities of sales continuing to grow, I believe we have a very, very good opportunity of increasing our total revenue associated with the fuel sales and service at the airport. Currently, we contract with them to do that. They pay us rent, but anything over and above their rent, of course, they take. So there would be some opportunity for us to increase our overall revenue stream.
He says additional revenue could go toward maintenance on the airport and toward matching grants for larger projects through the Federal Aviation Administration and through the Arkansas Department of Aeronautics.
City directors in Fort Smith last night approved an urban deer hunt for the Chaffee Crossing area. City directors voted 4-3 in favor of the hunts, which would see archers hunting from tree stands at least 10 feet off the ground. The hunts will be conducted as part of the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission's Urban Archery Deer Hunting Program. Fort Smith joined seven other cities in the state that held the hunts last year. Corey Gray, the Deer Program Coordinator for the Game and Fish Commission, says that the Urban Hunt Program uses a standardized set of rules aimed at ensuring resident safety.
It's a partnership with the Arkansas Bowhunters Association, the City Council, citizens of the town, and then the Arkansas Game and Fish. And we place them into a special zone. We can liberalize their bag limits. We remove antler restrictions. And we accept applicants for the hunt. Those that apply have to go through orientation. They have to go through different classes. They have to go through an urban deer hunt instruction class. They have to go through an international bow hunting course. And they have to take a proficiency test.
At its January 15th meeting, the Fort Smith Board of Directors also voted 4-3 in favor of the urban hunt. Because the issue failed to receive a 5-vote majority at either meeting, directors will have to vote in favor of the measure one more time before it can become official.
The University of Arkansas Advancement Division may soon be subject to scrutiny by auditors from the Arkansas General Assembly and the University of Arkansas System. Yesterday, Chancellor G. David Gerhart issued a statement asking for an independent audit of the division's spending that resulted in a deficit of more than $3.3 million. The university's treasurer reportedly reviewed the division's expenditures and found no misuse or misappropriation of university funds, but concerns were raised regarding job performance or lack thereof by officials with primary responsibility for the division's finances. State law prohibits the release of that audit because it includes assessments a specific individual's job performance. But that document, along with any other data requested, will be provided to auditors with the state legislature and the university system.
Tonight, there's a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms, lows in the mid to upper 40s throughout the region. Tomorrow, 80% chance of showers, possibly a thunderstorm. Highs will be around 60 in northwest Arkansas, mid-60s tomorrow afternoon in the Arkansas River Valley. And for Thursday night, 20% chance of showers. Lows will be around the mid-30s in northwest Arkansas. It's a 30% chance of rain in the Arkansas River Valley tomorrow night with lows in the lower to mid-40s.
Media coverage of the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in mid-December has finally quelled. But the memory continues to drive both heated debate on gun control as well as collaborative efforts to improve school security. In the first of two reports, Ozarks At-Large's Jacqueline Froelich examines emerging policies and practices to better protect schools.
Missy Thomas Irvin lives in Mountain View with her husband and four children. And like millions of parents across America, she was distraught when she learned a crazed gunman had killed 20 small children, their principal, and five teachers at an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut late last year.
And my first reaction was, what would have happened at my school with my children attending?
But this mom also happens to be Republican State Senator Irvin. And in late January, she filed SB 140, the Safe School Initiative Act. If passed, State Senator Irvin's bill would require and fund public schools to participate in active shooter drills and educate and train teachers and staff to prepare them for incidents of campus violence. She points to Sandy Hook as a case in point.
I really thought about, you know, had they been trained professionally to respond to that, then perhaps the principal wouldn't have gone at the shooter with her hands up, or, you know, perhaps the teachers would have reacted in a different way had they had the dialogue or the training.
Senator Irvin's been working closely with the Criminal Justice Institute based at the University of Arkansas in Little Rock. Director Cheryl May.
Yeah, CJI has been very fortunate to have had federal funding since 2000 to focus on school violence, either as a school violence resource center or to provide training.
CJI hosts classes on issues from cyberbullying to active school shooter situations. Violence prevention and drills are key program elements. Lawrence Johnson is CJI's Safe School Initiative Administrator. She says the moment a predator has been detected entering a campus, everyone should know what to do.
That teacher then should make sure that door is locked. They need to be in a corner so that if someone looks in the room, you can't visibly see them. If there's a gunman there, an active shooter, in the building, they need to stay on that lockdown until someone notify them that it's okay to move.
Schools should hold periodic violence drills, just like fire drills, but with very specific protocols, and staff need to have emergency communication devices on them at all times. On-site trained resource officers could help keep matters from escalating.
Our program promotes school resource officers who are sworn police officers who have been trained to carry a weapon.
The Arkansas Department of Education has also positioned itself on school violence.
We do appreciate the work that our superintendents, our school leaders, our teachers are doing to help ensure the safety of our students.
Spokesperson Phyllis Stewart, Chief of Staff, says the department has issued no statewide directive, but local districts are working to secure schools as best they can, despite no additional funding to do so.
Our districts have a crisis communications plan that they develop every year. And so I think they all took it on themselves to revisit that.
In early January, Arkansas State Police and the Arkansas Commission on Law Enforcement Standards and Training announced plans to form a collaborative committee, including local sheriffs and police chiefs, the State Police, and Arkansas Department of Emergency Management, to design a uniform preparedness training plan for active shooter situations in public schools. In an email for this story, Ken Jones, director of the Law Enforcement Training Academy, says they're standing by on deployment pending the outcome of Senator Missy Urban's Safe School Initiative measure. We have 170 private schools in Arkansas, along with 239 public school districts attended by 468,000 students. The second largest district is Springdale Public School System, and it's taking strict measures to protect its students. Yes, Jacqueline Froelich with KUAF National Public Radio here to meet Communications Director Rick Schaefer.
Come on in.
Thank you. You can no longer stride into Jones Elementary, population 500. Visitors are assessed via video surveillance by administrative staff. The school's locked except when students are arriving or leaving. District spokesperson Rick Schaefer.
Plans are to install this in seven more of our schools before this school year is over, and then the hope is that by next fall we'll have it in all of our schools. But we're starting with the elementary schools first.
The door alarms cost the district $3,000 to $5,000 each out of pocket. At first, parents balked, but after Sandy Hook, they welcome extra security, Schaefer said. All of Springdale's 20,000 students undergo monthly drills for tornadoes or fires and violence.
But the other drills we have on occasion, but we've got a system in place. Now, we don't say too much about what the system is because we just assume somebody who might want to violate that system not know a whole lot about it.
The local police force cannot patrol the district's 26 buildings, but the two high school and junior highs have security officers. All the elementary schools have heavy surveillance systems.
We do need to say that Connecticut proved that no method is foolproof because they had an excellent system in place. And that probably bought them a little bit of time.
Mental health professionals are on hand district-wide, monitoring and reaching out to troubled students. Benny Gooden is superintendent at Fort Smith, which has a total of 14,000 students. He said the district is constantly evaluating and updating school security.
You work your plan, and by that I mean you have periodic drills in which staff and students know what they are to do in a particular eventuality.
Emergency codes are standardized across the district, designed to alert local law enforcement trained in active shooter protocols.
First responders and our police, especially our police department. Fort Smith Police Department is just an integral part of our school district.
Fort Smith Public School District also employs video surveillance, but Fort Smith Superintendent Benny Gooden says they've not completely locked the campus. Everyone's required to check in at main entrances, however.
It's pretty difficult to do business in an open school setting, especially large secondary schools, with that kind of situation. We have certainly some perimeter control because we don't have every door unlocked. Most of the doors are in fact locked. I guess it troubled most of us that the school in Connecticut did have all their doors locked, and access was gained anyway.
Elkins School District, population 1,200, is not totally locked either, but Superintendent Megan Witonski is completely prepared for any contingency via the district's detailed continuity of operations plan.
We have active trainings on the weekends. We have the police department has set up an active shooter training class, which allows the police department to come in and actually use an actual facility, a school facility, and go through role-playing events that allow them to be properly prepared to respond to any potential dangers that could occur in a school.
Elkins School District holds periodic lockdown drills announced via intercom based on various threats or crisis scenarios.
And that can cover a bombing or bomb threat, earthquake, tornado, fire, possible suicide or attempted suicide, abduction, active shooter or terrorist attack, whichever, or even biological, chemical weapons or nuclear attacks.
Classrooms have fully equipped emergency crisis backpacks for teachers to grab during evacuation or lockdown. And the district also pays the local police to post a full-time resource officer on campus.
Although it is an expense, we feel like it's an important piece and a good component for us to feel like we have a strong relationship with the police department and that active conversation going on back and forth as they learn new information, sharing it with us, and as we learn new information, sharing it with them.
Post Sandy Hook, the National Rifle Association called for armed police officers to be posted in schools across America. The NRA also tasked former U.S. Congressman Asa Hutchinson to develop and lead a National School Shield Emergency Response Program. As former U.S. Department of Homeland Security Undersecretary, Congressman Hutchinson is an expert on security matters.
And right now, all across America, you're seeing school districts trying to figure out what more they can do to protect the children. And so I'm bringing together experts from all across the country to give these school districts more tools to keep the children safe, from online assessment tools to model training programs for our guards in our schools to school staff if necessary.
The resources will be free of charge. The National School Shield Emergency Response Program, to be made public April 1st, will also contain federal, state, and local cost-sharing recommendations to assist districts to achieve school security. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The U.S. Attorney's Office for the Western District of Arkansas and the Sebastian County Sheriff's Office is hosting a day-long Safe Schools seminar at the Fort Smith Convention Center February 20th. For details, call 479-494-4066.
This is Ozarks at Large. This winter, several area schools have closed because of illness. For some schools and districts, the nemesis has been the flu, while for others, the problem has been a rapidly spreading norovirus. A norovirus can be incredibly unpleasant. Projectile vomiting and diarrhea. It can also spread easily, remain on shared surfaces for a long period of time. Kristen Gibson, an assistant professor of molecular food safety and microbiology in the Dale Bumpers College of Agricultural Food and Life Sciences at the University of Arkansas, has studied the norovirus for about 10 years. She's with me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First of all, the norovirus is not the flu. Now, I know that when I was a kid and we'd get hit with something that was gastrointestinal, we'd call it the stomach flu, but that's not really a proper term, is it?
No, it's a common misnomer, and you'll even find on, say, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention webpage, they'll often say norovirus, or otherwise called the stomach flu. And the problem is that flu usually means a respiratory virus, but norovirus is a gastrointestinal virus. So they are no way related as far as the virus goes.
The bad news is you can have both at the same time, though.
Yes, that is the bad news.
Well, what is a norovirus, and it seems to spread fast?
Norovirus is specific to humans, at least the one that infects humans, and it causes gastrointestinal symptoms, as you said, so vomiting and diarrhea. It spreads so fast because the incubation period is only 12 to 24 hours. Mm. So often, sometimes people may be like, oh, I have, you know, the stomach flu, because the flu often comes on very fast and hard. So you have a really small incubation period, and for 24 to 48 hours, you're feeling pretty bad. So so those are the hallmark signs of having a norovirus infection. Because of the way the virus is built or its structure, it's able to survive for very long periods of time in the environment. So on surfaces that we touch frequently, on our hands, it's often associated with contaminated drinking water and food. So you have a lot of different ways that you can come into contact with norovirus.
Can it spread if I have it on my hand and I shake your hand?
Yes, it can spread that way. That's probably one of the most common ways, person-to-person transmission. So that person could either have contaminated their own hands because they were sick, or they could have touched a contaminated surface, then touched another person's hand, and then that person touches their mouth, and there you go.
So washing your hands, which is always a good idea, especially good here.
Yes, washing your hands is the best thing that you could possibly do. I don't want people to be paranoid and not want to go outside and touch surfaces, but really, if you are in a public place, just be really conscious not to touch your face as much as you might normally do, and wash your hands with warm water and soap.
Hand sanitizer doesn't cut it?
Hand sanitizer does not work against norovirus, unfortunately. The problem is that there are so many different formulations of hand sanitizer that unless you really know what you're looking for, you're probably not going to get the one that's effective. And when I say effective, they've shown like mild effectiveness against norovirus, but your typical run-of-the-mill hand sanitizer is not going to work.
Before the schools had problems with it, it seems like the location I would most hear associated would be cruise ships. There was this wave of cruise ships. What is it about schools and cruise ships that make the norovirus?
Well, you're just in it's not like you're confined, but you are in somewhat of a closed space. At this time of year, you have what you would call a large population of susceptible people. So you're in one area, you're using shared facilities. At schools, you have cafeterias, restrooms, locker rooms. I'm sure kids like to high five, hug, whatever it is. And so as soon as one person or two people introduces this virus into this kind of enclosed facility, it'll get on all sorts of surfaces, and that's just what it does, spreads rapidly. And so similar with cruise ships. I mean, you may have a couple people who decided to take a cruise, and maybe they were sick a couple days ago, and they get on that ship, and it just spreads.
Yeah. Isn't it true that you can get better? You can be over your bout with the norovirus, but you still might infect other people afterward?
Yes, that is the hard part about norovirus is you can have, they've shown in clinical trials, the few clinical trials that have been done, that a person can shed this virus in numbers that would cause infection for up to 3 weeks after showing symptoms. So as much as people try not to be around others when they're actually symptomatic, afterwards is when they're thinking, oh, I'm much better now, but they still have a high virus load. And unfortunately, if you don't already have good hygiene practices, then you could definitely be the reservoir to make other people sick.
Every year, we professionals kind of make a pretty good guess about what flu is coming, and they load up on the vaccine and they get vaccine. Can we do that with norovirus?
Yes and no. This year, they did have a good idea that there may be a new dominant strain that was going to start circulating, and that's why this particular one, it's not causing all of the outbreaks, but it's causing 60% of the outbreaks that have occurred, is called the Sydney strain, because it began in Australia, or that's where they first were able to genotype this strain. And so they found out about this. It was circulating there in March, April, and then come maybe October, they released a report about this new variant. And at that same time, you see this spike in norovirus outbreaks across the U.S. and also globally. And like I said, most of them are due to this new variant. So being able to predict that this would come around to the U.S. is somewhat difficult. It's not quite as easy as, say, predicting the flu. They've had a lot longer time to study the flu and understand the ecology of flu viruses and how they work. Now, every year there's a dominant strain of flu, but there's also other circulating strains. So,
what attracted you to the study of norovirus?
Well, that's an interesting question. So I initially started out down at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, and I worked at a water quality lab. And we did a lot of work with waterborne diseases and also just your indicator organisms to test to see if the drinking water is okay. And when I finished my undergrad, my mentor there asked me, what did I want to do? And I was like, well, I was thinking about going to medical school, but actually now I want to do something in public health. something related to water, maybe food. And she got me in contact with my PhD advisor, Dr. Kellogg Schwab, at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And I worked in his lab for 3 years, and he came from a lab that did norovirus research. So when I was in his lab, I did a lot of work on different outbreaks. We would get samples from the Maryland Department of Health. Sometimes we would get calls from other areas of the country where they had an outbreak and they needed the sample processed. One of the issues is the departments of health have the capacity to test clinical samples, but if they're trying to figure out the origin of this outbreak, if it's say contaminated surfaces or food or water, there's no standard methodology. And so they would just reach out to people who did that work, send them the samples and say, hey, you know, can you find out if this sample has norovirus in it? We've tested deli sandwiches, wedding cakes, slices of pizza. We got sent carpet because someone got sick on hotel carpet and the carpet wasn't clean well enough, and it re-aerosolized and caused a recurring outbreak. So it was amazing what we were able to do. And so that's kind of my exposure, my PhD advisor. That's his favorite virus. So I was exposed and, you know, was able to work with it, fortunately, for 10 years.
This may be a silly question, but if someone has contaminated carpet or a suspect slice of wedding cake, how do they send it? Do they put it in a box and say, here it is? And then what do you do to get it out? I mean, you got to be careful, right?
With the wedding cake, it was just a frozen piece of wedding cake. And everything we do in the lab is in a biological safety cabinet, so we take all the precautions we can. With the carpet, that was an interesting scenario, and then they send us probably an 8 by 5 foot piece of carpet that we rolled out in the lab with mask on, and we cut out little pieces, and we were like, well, let's see what happens. And we detected it, and we were in disbelief, trust us. We just couldn't believe it.
Kristen Gibson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The world's megacities give off lots of waste heat, and that has effects.
This waste heat might have moved the jet stream a little bit southwards. When the jet stream moves south is when you get huge cold spell in areas like Florida, Texas.
How the way we live could be changing our weather. I'm Steve Curwood. Join me next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Living on Earth, Sunday afternoons at 5 here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
The results of the latest edition of the Blair Center Clinton School poll are announced today. A panel discussion about the poll began at noon in Little Rock at the Clinton School of Public Service. It's a national poll and is a collaboration between the Diane D. Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society at the University of Arkansas and the University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service in Little Rock. This year's poll asked more than 3,000 respondents about the 2012 presidential election, Hillary Clinton's potential as a candidate for the presidency in 2016, student loan debt, and gender issues. Last week, before the full poll results were released, two of the researchers associated with the project came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Pearl Ford Dow and Rafael Jimeno are assistant professors of political science at the University of Arkansas. I asked them about some of the poll's findings.
Well, when we look at how gender discrimination persists, when we look at men from the ages of 18 to 19, about 25% still hold negative attitudes towards women in comparison to 25% of men over 60. And so that's significant because the assumption is that younger people with this, you know, with our community now where people are more engaged, more interactive, communities are more integrated in various ways, you would assume that young men would not have negative attitudes. So we see that this age gap is not there as much as we thought it would be. So that was somewhat significant. Also, what we've also found was that educational attainment does seem to be related to the attitudes, and which is somewhat inconsistent with what we know about the research about the fact that, or the idea that someone, if they're more educated, they're more exposed, they're less likely to hold negative attitudes towards various groups. And so we saw that as well.
You know, one interesting qualifier to follow up on what Pearl just said is that you actually see a spike in these sexist attitudes for people who have some college education. And again, we have to keep investigating the relationships between these variables. But our guess is that this is a function of labor market competition. But Pearl is absolutely right. The minute you start looking then at people who actually finished college and have a degree, sexist attitudes drop significantly. So there is this really interesting relationship between level of education and sexism.
What else did you find that? Because that's quite interesting. I was with you, Pearl. I would assume that the younger respondents are, the less likely they are to have.
And I think Raphael makes a great point about the competition, because what we know is that persons that are lower income or have lower levels of education and even younger, they're competing for lower paid types of jobs, which men and women are both doing. And so there's a greater sense of competition that they're probably sensing with women. And even if we look at the recession and how the recession has the process of the recession recovery, where we see women actually being a little more successful in acquiring jobs and maintaining jobs, where men lost a lot of jobs early on, such as in construction, and now those men are now trying to find jobs in which they're competing with women. So I think the labor competition is probably really what is really driving this. As far as how women perceive sexism, we did find that many women, most women, they do interpret innocent remarks as being sexist. So jokes and comments and whistles and even things of compliments sometimes, women still perceive as sexist. And in many cases, particularly if they are in the workplace, they are inappropriate. And so women are still responding to the fact that those things are still happening to them. Also, we found that women, when they are losing to men in a sense of fair competition, that we see that they are complaining about discrimination. So women are conscious of discrimination in the workplace. And so even though we don't talk about it a lot culturally anymore, you know, we don't talk about sexual harassment anymore because it's assumed that it doesn't really happen anymore because all the laws that are in place and, you know, following the Clarence Thomas issue. But women are still cognizant of the fact of the disparities that are happening with hiring and with wages.
Any questions asked about the likelihood of voters being, I mean, because we're talking about 40 years ago was when Diane Blair did her study. I would assume, and you should never assume, but I would assume that attitudes toward people who would be willing to vote for a woman have changed. Any questions about that?
Oh, yeah. The one thing that we were really excited about, I mean, this is something that we came up with when we were designing the survey, of course, with Angie Maxwell and Todd Shields. We came up with this question to see how many people would support Hillary Clinton's presidency bid, if it ever comes to that, against specific candidates. So we included Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, Marco Rubio, and I mean, no surprise, you see it all over the news that she's one of the most popular politicians currently. And our results show that she would beat all of these candidates in hypothetical matchups in 2016. Some differences between men and women. Obviously, women are more likely to support Hillary Clinton against all these candidates than men are. But the support from men is still above 50% for her, with only slight variations depending on the candidate, whether it's Rubio or Christie, and slight variations depending on race, whether you're talking about all respondents or specifically Latinos or specifically African Americans. Really interesting stuff.
And also, we looked at this regionally as well. And so Clinton's support in the South drops a little bit. And so respondents outside.
But she's a Democrat, and you would expect that any Democrats support in the South would be a little bit less.
A little bit.
Absolutely.
And so her response, well, the support for her outside of the South was between 66% and 69%. And if we look at in the South, it hovers around 64%. And then when we add racial demographics and look at head-to-head matches, what we found was that African-American men were least supportive of her if she was to run against Chris Christie, which was very interesting. So that would be very important if she does run, and Christie or someone who African-American men may be a little more favorable to, because that may have a role in turnout, which could be very important for her if she decides to run.
I know you try not to make assumptions, but as the numbers are compiling, are you ever surprised? You go, huh, that's not really the way I thought it would turn out?
The one thing I will say was kind of surprising is we noticed gender gaps, you know, mm-hmm. perceptions between men and women in almost everything, including support for Hillary Clinton, you know. But the one thing that was surprising was there was no gender gap for the Latino community, or a relatively tiny one of 2% or less, mm-hmm. Meaning that both men and women in the Latino community tended to express similar opinions or tended to support Hillary Clinton at similar levels, which is not exactly the way it happens in other communities. And it seems like the impact of ethnicity in this case is similar to the impact of party, where it's a homogenizing force. So there's obviously less gender gap in amongst Democrats, right, in their support of Hillary Clinton, because you're a Democrat, you're going right. to support the Democratic nominee, than there is amongst Republicans. For Republicans, there's a much bigger gender gap. So, you know, looking at what could be causing this, what could make it so that Latinos and Latinas both express similar preferences for this candidate, you know, the only thing that comes to mind is the importance of the Clinton brand. I mean, there's been a lot written about the fact that under President Clinton's administration, thousands of Latinos moved into the middle class, and so the Clinton name is associated with an era of prosperity that was really beneficial for the community. And so I think Hillary Clinton benefits from that, and so gender differences kind of disappear in light of the impact that the Clinton name has for the community.
Rafael Jimeno and Pearl Ford Dow are assistant professors of political science at the University of Arkansas and two of the researchers who worked on the Blair Clinton School poll. They discussed the poll's results in Little Rock today, along with Todd Shields, director of the Blair Center and professor of political science, and Angie Maxwell, assistant professor of political science. Kyle's conversation with Pearl and Rafael took place last week before the full results of the poll had been released.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Angie Grajeda.
With us is Christina Thomas.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, of course.
Yes. You're here to help us introduce a culinary event.
Right. We have started an Ozarks at Large food series. And it kind of started, I wanted to come in and introduce it because it started because the three of us went to a gala across the street at the public library. And we were kind of talking because the public library had a signature drink.
For that event.
For the event.
Right.
And I was excited about it. I know everybody else was kind of excited about it. And we said that we would like to have an Ozarks at Large cocktail.
And what would be in that?
Right.
Right. So, and then we kind of started talking about other food items that could be an Ozarks at Large inspired thing. And we came up with an omelet, a pizza, you know, just various items.
Yes.
And so Bill Lyle, executive chef at Ella's Restaurant, offered to do a brunch dish for us.
Inspired by the program.
Right. He says he typically gets his, inspiration from past experiences. He loves to travel and create things, recreate things. And so this is sort of his take on different various breakfast items all put together into one. It's the Ozarks at Large Quiche Cup.
Now, usually when he's in the kitchen, he and his staff, they're listening to KUAF, aren't they?
All the time. When I walked in, it was on.
Ah.
That's always fun.
So here is how Ozarks at Large inspired him.
What is Ozarks at Large to us? You know, for us, it's relaxing to listen to Ozarks at Large. It's just easy news, non-biased, of course, and it's all inclusive. It seems like you guys use the whole team down there for Ozarks at Large. So as far as just relaxing, easy listening, I've started thinking about comfort food. And as far as all-inclusive, this is a brunch item that's pretty original to us. I've never seen it before, and it uses almost my entire staff. You know, it starts with my pastry chef and different aspects of the line. It'll go from the grill all the way down to saute as far as the items that we put into this cup. So I kind of thought that was representative of Ozarks at Large, as in the entire staff is involved in creating this dish.
I like it.
Cool.
Okay.
You ready to cook?
Yeah.
All right.
The all-inclusive kitchen quiche cup experience begins with Cody, Ellis pastry chef. who has prepared a quiche dough with sour cream to make the crust fluffy and crispy. Bill takes a handful of the dough and rolls it out, thin, to about the size of a salad plate, literally. He uses one to make sure the dough is just the right size. He then takes an extra large muffin tin, two of them. But the rolled out dough isn't going on the inside. Bill sprays the bottom of one tin with nonstick oil, wrapping the dough around the cup, then placing it inside the second tin. The crust for our quiche cup heads to the oven. While that bakes, Chef Bill preps the ingredients for the fill of the cups.
First things first, let's shred a potato into some cold water and let's rinse the starch off a little bit, let it sit for 10 minutes. Okay, so I'm gonna take just the regular russet potato. I'm gonna peel it, shred it for our hash browns, and this will be the very first level or layer in our quiche cup.
While the potatoes soak, Chef Bill preps the other ingredients. So today we'll be keeping at Ozarks, most of them were found regionally.
My eggs will be from Cedar Creek Farms, as well as my uncured bacon. And my mushrooms are from Sweden Creek Farms. And our flour for the quiche dough is from War Eagle Mill.
While he's talking, he's running around the kitchen.
And we got a couple other local ingredients here. But as far as produce, there's only so much available right now. I actually bought the bacon and some of my produce here at the Wren Thicket Market, which is a nice little winter market here in Fayetteville.
Even the cheese for the dish, because of course it has to have cheese, it's brunch. Even the cheese is made locally in Little Rock, using all Arkansas ingredients. Bill shreds this cheddar habanero. He then moves to sharpen his knife for slicing the vegetables. After sharpening his knife, he begins to slice or julienne the red and green bell peppers, purple onion, and shiitake mushrooms into long, thin pieces. And then he prepares a hollandaise, though it won't be needed until the product is finished. With so few ingredients, making a decent hollandaise is tricky business, at least for me. But Chef Bill is a pro. He uses both white wine vinegar and lemon juice. A lot of people use one or the other. He reduces the vinegar and melts some butter to the perfect temperature so that the sauce sets correctly. Two egg yolks, cayenne, salt, and then puts this in a double boiler. He slowly pours in sugar, whisking it together. Setting it aside for later use, but making sure it stays the right temperature as to not separate. Ella's prep kitchen is downstairs. Ingredients are carried upstairs for the final rounds of the cooking process, but not before Bill pulls the baked quiche cup from the oven.
Our final product here in the quiche cup is a perfectly round, nice cup-shaped pastry, which is perfect for, you can put anything in it. And my favorite part about it is that it's all the best parts of the quiche, minus the quiche.
He grabs the bacon, shredded potatoes, sliced veggies, hollandaise, eggs, and cheese, and heads upstairs, carefully balancing these elements on a silver tray. And he begins to cook.
All right, let's throw the bacon down on the flat top.
After removing excess water from the potatoes, he tosses them into a pan of hot bacon grease, allowing them to fry and crisp up. The sliced veggies go into an aluminum pan, along with a bit of garlic, not cooking them long so that they remain al dente.
We're actually going to start building our quiche cup now. We are going to layer in, we're going to put the potatoes in first, the very bottom, and then I like to put a little bit of cheese over those. Kind of press them in there. And we'll put the vegetable mixture on top of that. A lot of veggies. Yeah. And next we'll cut our bacon in half so it'll fit in there. And then I will top that with the rest of the cheese.
We've got potatoes, cheese, veggies, bacon, cheese. And we'll put that in the oven for about 5 minutes so the cheese melt.
While that's in the oven, he cooks one egg sunny side up. Bill's trick to cooking the perfect sunny side up egg is to put it in cold oil, then put it on the heat. Start on high heat, turning it to low to let it cook through without having to flip it over. We're almost finished, but not quite. The plate, of course, has to look pretty. Bill takes a square white plate and prepares to garnish. He deep fries some basil leaves. Yep, deep fried basil leaves. He takes two cherry tomatoes, slices them on the bottom so that they stand up straight, placing another slice on the top for the basil leaf to fit right in. The plate also holds a small ceramic ramekin filled with the creamy yellow hollandaise that we made earlier. He pulls the cup from the oven.
The cup is filled all the way to the top. Let's just slide the sunny side up egg on top. And there we go.
Awesome.
Ozarks at Large inspired breakfast dish. And this is will actually be going on to my brunch menu here at Ella's Restaurant. It'll be on the menu every Sunday morning, and we'll probably run it for the next few months. So thank you for the inspiration.
And to eat this beautiful Ozarky quiche cup, Bill suggests slicing it right down the middle, revealing all of the tasty layers. And get a forkful of everything. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
To see video of Chef Bill Lyle creating the Ozarks at Large quiche cup, visit ozarksatlarge.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Sunday night, the 2013 Grammy Awards will be handed out at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. It's the 55th edition of the Grammys. Nominees for the most high-profile awards include the Lumineers, Frank Ocean, the Black Keys, Fun, Taylor Swift, and Mumford & Sons. Wayne Bell is with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to help us get ready for Sunday night. Wayne, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Very, very good. And, you know, when you look at the lineup of nominees and presenters and performers for Sunday night, it seems like the Grammy Awards have put together a pretty interesting show.
Well, you would think during the Super Bowl that they must be really proud of them because they kept running this commercial. And then they would go, that's just in the first hour. Yeah. And I was like, I know what hour three of the Grammys feel like.
They feel like 2 hours.
Yeah, it's like here comes the tributes
right. And
the, you know, the special performances by people that you thought had passed years ago and...
You know, the Grammys, for years, more than any of the other big award shows, had a reputation for being out of step with kind of what was the best in music. You look at the nomination list this year and Critics' Best 10, and there's a lot of carryover. That it seems like there has been a concerted effort over the last few years to try to honor not necessarily just the best-selling music, but the music that at least to some degree also is the most respected among the critics.
Well, yeah, and you know, you always notice it with the nominations, and now with the winners, you know, they've really tried to branch out. So they have a branch in Memphis and in Nashville and, you know, Seattle. So all these different regions have a voice. You know, you hope that the best gets rewarded. It still rarely does. You know, last year was great with Adele, but this year, you know, I guess that they did nominate the best they had, but it just wasn't that great a year. Like, I kept looking over the nominations and going, I wonder in a few years if we're going to remember who Fun or Gautier
right.
or, you know, yeah, some of these other acts are, but for what they had to pick from, I guess they did fine.
Well, Record of the Year nominees include the Black Keys for Lonely Boy, Kelly Clarkson for Stronger, Fun for We Are Young, Somebody That I Used to Know, Gautier, and Frank Ocean, Thinking About You, and Taylor Swift, We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together, yet another song from Taylor Swift about breaking up or something.
Yeah, and they must have had a tie because they ended up with six of them.
Now, last year, as you mentioned, everyone knew that Adele was going to sweep. No such front runner, I think, this year. Maybe
no.
Frank Ocean.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily see that happening. I don't think that I can't see that necessarily happening. I would say for Record of the Year, which is for the overall production of a song, I think it's probably between Fun and Gautier. And I don't know which way that's going to go. I mean, both of those songs kind of make me tick a little now after hearing them so much. But, you know, I like the Kelly Clarkson song. It's empowering. I love the Black Keys song. And it's probably going to go to Fun or Gautier. And I guess if you went by nomination count alone, it would be Fun because they're all over those top categories. The big category is Album of the Year.
Right. The nominated artists are the Black Keys, Fun, Mumford & Sons, Frank Ocean, and Jack White.
I wish the Black Keys would win that, but I have a feeling it's probably between Mumford & Sons and
Frank Ocean.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like that would be right for Mumford & Sons. They're one of those groups that is nominated a lot at the Grammys, but they've never won.
All right, so I'll be watching, as will you, right?
Yeah, it's always a good show.
All right. And quickly, one of the hardest things to do in show business is to perform at halftime of the Super Bowl Sunday night. Beyonce was the latest. I thought she did a great job.
I did, too. I thought she did really great and made the best of her 12 minutes.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
Bay State Republicans look for somebody to run for Senate after Scott Brown and Tag Romney nix the idea. Jersey's Bob Menendez says he's being smeared. New Yorkers remember Ed Koch, and Hillary Clinton leaves big shoes to fill at the State Department. I'm Neil Cunnan. Political junkie Ken Rudin returns, plus Hank Stuver on the Americans and rooting for the bad guys. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM. KUAF is supported by Arcom Printing, located on the hillside just east of the Township and College intersection in Fayetteville. Arcom Printing provides printing, copying, and digital output services. ArcomPrinting.com or 444-7711 for more information.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Leadhill.
Leadhill.
Boone County. Leadhill is north of South Leadhill.
Of course it is.
Well, you never know.
Well, right. Sure. I haven't been there in a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Let's see. We both went to see Memphis.
We did.
At Walton Arts Center, opening night.
Their latest touring Broadway show came in. I enjoyed it.
I did too.
I really didn't know much about it. I knew it was in Memphis.
Right. And.
But it's fairly new.
Yeah, won the Tony for Best Musical in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was an outstanding cast, but we both agree that the woman whose real name is Felicity, who plays the character Felicity.
Felicia.
Yes, Felicia.
The lead, yes. The female lead in the play.
Right.
Her voice was phenomenal.
Yes.
Like, she plays a singer, and I've seen a lot of musicals, and of course they're all professionals and everything like that, but I guess I hadn't seen one where the lead character was an actual singer. Holy cow. Her range was amazing. Yeah. And she's such a little thing and just with such a big voice.
Right.
It was great.
William Perry, who played the radio station owner, will be on the show tomorrow. He's coming by.
Perfect.
We'll talk to him. Yes.
Excellent. Looking forward to that.
Hats off to the Razorback basketball team.
Oh my gosh, yes.
We both got to see the first half and go to the theater.
And as soon as the lights went up, everybody was on their phone at intermission trying to check it. And somebody announced to us that they had won. So pleasantly surprised last night for everything.
Yes.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grahita.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Tune in tomorrow at noon when Kyle will be back with Christina Thomas.
Yes, for a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large.
We'll be back on Friday. Have a great Wednesday.